freedom, personal freedom, is fundamental to who we are as Americans.
There's nothing more important, nothing more sacred.
That's been the work of my first term, to fight for our democracy.
This shouldn't be a red or blue issue.
To protect our rights, to make sure that everyone in this country is treated equally and that everyone is given a fair shot at making it. But you know, around the country, MAGA extremists are lining up to take on those bedrock freedoms, cutting Social Security that you paid for your entire life while cutting taxes for the very wealthy, dictating what healthcare decisions women can make, banning books, and telling people who they can love.
Biden is
all while making it more difficult.
President of the United States again for his second term in office. He will be running against political hopefuls such as Donald Trump, Tim Scott, Nikki Haley, and a host of others. Once again, Black America will determine the direction of our democracy in the 2024 election. We understand what Biden has done on the domestic front to address some of the social issues that have plagued Black America. He has instituted more diversity, equity, inclusion policies. He's pushed for the first Black woman to serve on the Supreme Court Justice, Ketanji Jackson Brown. He has tried to address some of the criminal justice issues facing Black America. But what has he done in terms of U.S. foreign policy and its impact on the African diaspora? In this three-part series, we're going to look at Europe, Africa, and Latin America. And so we're going to talk to Mr. Nice Simmons, non-resident senior fellow at Atlantic Council and Center for Global Development. He is a leader in emerging and frontier markets with extensive experience in innovation and technology with a focus on Africa. We're also going to talk to Dr. Nola Hayes, Georgetown University professor. She's also a security fellow at the Truman National Security Project. This is Global Take, and I hope you enjoy this episode.
Just like what you were able to do at the World Bank in terms of African engagement, can you speak a little bit about like why it's so critical for us to engage with the diaspora when it comes to development in Africa?
Sure. So the diaspora engagement has been going on for eons, right? Even within Africa, we have migration of citizens from one country to another for a lot of it's for economic reasons, others because of conflict and fragility, right? And unfortunately, in the past year and a half, 2-3 years, we've seen a lot of the fragility. But the diaspora engagement I'm talking about are the diaspora who are in rich countries who've taken their experiences and their knowledge to support development of their country of origin, right? And the program we started was really focused on using the diaspora to help support countries of origin, to engage your diaspora in a meaningful, holistic way, and you know, to utilize the talents of the diaspora, right? When it comes to diaspora engagement, I think we have to kind of take a step back, because in DC, you know, although this has changed a bit, in DC, when you hear about diaspora engagement, before it was about engaging people in the diaspora to provide a financial means to support a project in a country, right? And I think that's a mistake. You know, if you are trying to engage a citizen, somebody from your country to invest in something they can't hear or see or touch, it's going to be problematic, especially when you have diaspora who've been outside of a country for a couple of decades, right? And you know, if you're a diaspora who doesn't trust your country of origin, or you have some, you know, you have some issues with the current government, you may not want to give back, right? But if you go back and forth and you see things, you know, there's some things that you may want to invest. But I think for when I talk about diaspora engagement, it's really about using the brain power and the technical assistance of the diaspora to support projects. When I talk about diaspora engagement, I always talk about these three countries, because these three countries are doing a phenomenal job not only engaging in diaspora, but they use their diaspora as an economic lever, as brand ambassadors, and you know they're doing a wonderful job. So I always mention Ireland, Israel, and India. Right, Ireland has used they've attracted companies to Ireland using their tax code, but they use their Irish diaspora. If you look at most tech companies, U.S. tech companies have set up offices, domiciled them in Ireland because of the tax code. That's changed a bit because there's a harmonization of tax authority across most OECD countries. Israel has used its cultural identity to engage people of its diaspora. If you are of Jewish origin, Israel has used the Birthright program and other initiatives to engage your diaspora. But there's strong cultural ties, right? Same thing with India, you know. But India is the demographic of India, the amount of Indians globally. It's just the quantity and the density in countries, especially in the US and the UK and Canada, gives them a tremendous advantage that other countries just cannot mimic. And India now, because of COVID and in the pandemic, India is now known as the number one country for vaccines and over-the-counter over-the-counter medications. And why is that? It's because of the Indian diaspora that went to some of the best schools in the West, brought those skills back, and have founded companies like Dr. Reddy, Ranbaxy, other pharmaceutical companies. And now India's the number one producer of vaccines and other pharmaceutical products. In Africa, there's two countries that I always mention. That's Rwanda and Ethiopia. And real quick, Ethiopia, that Grand Renaissance Dam, the new Renaissance Dam that has been built, that was built on the back of using engaging the Ethiopian diaspora globally. And it took decades. I was just talking to a young man the other day. He told me it took 3 decades to raise that kind of money to develop this dam. And it wasn't financed by the World Bank. It wasn't financed by the African Development Bank or any other bank. That's 100% Ethiopia funds, you know. And even though some of the neighbors have some issues because of the Nile Dam and it being dammed, that sort of thing, Ethiopia needs electricity. They need affordable electricity to industrialize, to turn on lights so that kids can learn. Hospitals are open so you can do surgery. Without electricity, you can't develop in Africa.
Then speaking of that, what do you think is hindering? I know, like we lived in Rwanda for 4 years, so I'm very familiar with how President Kagame does his engagement with the diaspora. He goes on U.S. tours, if you will, to universities, to think tanks, to world events, both the United States and abroad, speaking. He was definitely here at the U.S.-Africa Summit, the Semaphore event. And that really attracts both the locals who live in those Western countries, as well as like the diaspora, and that keeps the country relevant. So what do you think? I mean, that's his approach, but what do you think? Why you feel that other African countries, you know, haven't done the same? I know Ghana does a really great job, at least reaching out to Black Americans in the Caribbean. What are the roadblocks to on the African side to really tap into their into their diaspora network?
Yeah. Good question. And just to reiterate or rephrase you, so there's 2 things there, right? You mentioned Rwanda, Kagame, and Ghana, and I'm sure you're probably referring to the year of return, which was more of a cultural type of thing, especially for Black Americans after the 400 years of first slave ship landing in Jamestown, Virginia. Let's talk about it first, Rwanda. You know, Kagame has done a phenomenal job engaging there. Rwandese diaspora. They have no choice. I mean, it's a landlocked country. They don't have a natural, seaport. So for it to grow, the only way to grow is to use this diaspora to entice and incentivize Western companies. If you look at Rwanda, most of the tech companies that you see are mostly Western. I would say 70-80% of the companies have a US, Canada, or UK type of origin to them, but they use their diaspora. I mean, you have American universities like Carnegie Mellon has a beautiful campus there. The African Leadership Academy or African Leadership University, I believe they have a campus there. I've never been to Rwanda. I heard they've done great job to attract all these entities there, and it's because they're the diaspora. And Kagame has done a great job. I know there's other countries have taken notice. I know Kenya has done some interesting things with their diaspora, but Rwanda, not only do they get it right, they use their consulates and embassies overseas to engage your diaspora. Before Kagame goes overseas, the embassies and consulates go out of their way to make sure that the diaspora know that he's coming, and the engagement is an ongoing type of effect. They've done some things with sponsoring football tournaments. I believe the Arsenal football team in the UK, London, there's a Visit Rwanda they have on their uniforms. So they have really pushed the envelope to make Rwanda a destination to set up shop. But also Rwanda has primates that are unique, indigenous to that part of Africa. So if you are a nature lover, if you're an outdoors person, you want to visit, you can visit. You pay a fee, and you can, you can hang out in the bush with gorillas as long as you're careful. So that's one example. And then you mentioned Ghana. I'm Ghanaian American. I think Ghana did a great job to attract. Let me take a step back. Ghana had, based on the 400 years of first slave ships that landed in Jamestown, Virginia, Ghana used that occasion, and its celebrity, the diaspora celebrity power, people like Boris Kujo and others, to attract, African Americans who have an opportunity to see where their ancestors came from, right? It's unfortunate. Was unfortunate, but it's also fortunate. It's unfortunate, but Ghana has a relic of its past that's in some cases it's still in a pristine condition.
What was your impression of people's African Summit?
Those are slave castles, right? I think it's unfortunate. The administration did a great job to slave castles have an event. It came. I know some people were not happy with how
last minute it was.
Yeah, it was last minute delays, but sometimes things happen, and it happens, and it works out, right? I think the Biden administration, not only did they need to do something like this, they did a decent job. I mean, I didn't go to any of the official events, but from what I can gather and from what I've heard, and I had some couple discussions with some attachés who were supporting these delegations that came, and they said, some said, yeah, we were, we met with somebody from U.S. Africa Foundation, or we went with somebody from, DFC, and, the U.S. government opened up its departments to some of these leaders, and And to all the leaders that showed up, that's up. All the leaders that showed up, there was meetings with several, U.S. agencies who were providing, whether it's technical assistance, whether it's grants or loans. There was discussions, and we need to have, U.S. government needs to have that type of engagement, because other countries have done something, have done similar things and have gone beyond. We cannot compete with a said country when it comes to infrastructure, because I'll say China. We can't compete with China when it comes to infrastructure because of certain things like Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. I think that my experience or my humble belief, I think the Chinese have done a decent job to develop infrastructure in Africa. So when it comes to hard stuff, let the Chinese develop that. When it comes to the soft stuff, tech, health, innovation, I think that's the advantage that the U.S. government can bring to bear through its, whether it's DFC, whether it's USAID, whether it's some programs of State Department. Ex-Im is a little bit limited, but there's Ex-Im Bank. And I don't think this should be like a U.S. versus whoever. I think for Africa, this is the first time I can recollect that it has a chance, it has a choice to make, right? It's akin to when you're a kid, you're playing, and there's a child in the neighborhood who had the best toy everybody wanted to play with. Africa has a lollipop that everybody wants to lick or they want to play with, right? And we, I think the continent is in a position to choose its partners wisely, right? But what does that mean for leadership? I think we have to develop the next future leaders on the continent who can make these decisions, the right decisions for that particular country, right? Whether it's the U.S., China, or whoever. The administration did a decent job. I think Joe Biden has he just recently announced a president for the World Bank. I wish he would have picked a female, but that's just neither here nor there. I think, time will tell, but I think this is something that you gotta give the administration credit for. I don't know if I answered all your questions.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, the Chinese, I think what he's been able to do, like at least having that conference was instrumental to strengthening those African relations, especially given what happened the last administration. And the Chinese are definitely ahead of us with that. But I hope we can continue. I hope this can be like an annual or biannual type of conference. But speaking on that note, what do you think Biden has gotten right when it comes to U.S.-Africa policy? And what do you think he's gotten wrong? Or what can we do more to deepen those relationships?
Sure. Before I answer those questions, I want to, you mentioned something that I was just actually speaking about this a few weeks ago. That was, in terms of, I forgot to comment, but you said, the last administration, the last administration, I think, there was a focus on America, right? Which, that's what they ran on. And, if you're going to run on something like that, then you have to put all your eggs in one basket. This administration, based on what's going on geopolitically, there's a U.S. CHIPS Act, critical minerals are being discussed. I just wrote a paper about semiconductors and its impact to the UK defense supply chain. Africa is at a point where there are all these critical minerals that are being sought after over the world, and they have an opportunity, countries have an opportunity to make sure these natural treasures they have are benefiting their people. Zimbabwe just said the other, a couple months ago, that no longer will they allow an export of raw lithium or cobalt outside of Zimbabwe, right? So what does that mean for a company like, or for Elon Musk and his company Tesla? That means if you want a cobalt lithium battery, you have to put together a processing plant in Zimbabwe. Same thing in Nigeria. Nigeria has also mentioned this. These are types of leadership decisions that we need. Now, your question you asked me, look, I mean, Biden is not perfect. I think given he doesn't have infinite resources, he has finite resources, and he also has to, you know, U.S. is not an autocratic state, right? He has to deal with his party. You have to deal with the opposition, and he would like to do some things. I mean, let's not forget in the 80s, he was one of the first senator. When he was a senator, he had an interview about apartheid and how evil it was, right? And you know, this is somebody I think who has Africa in his mind. There are a lot of issues around the world. I think he's done a good job. On a scale of 1 to 10, I can't give him a 10. I mean, he's been in office for what, 20, you know, 26.
He's going on third year.
Third year, 26, 27 months. You know, he's doing what he can. The British had their summit last year. I will commend him for putting together this executive order for a diaspora council, right? It has yet to be announced who will be on that council, but I like that because, you know, these are the people who are going to sort of advise him on things on Africa. Johnny Carson is sort of he came out of retirement, worked part-time to make sure these commitments to these countries are met. So he's overseeing, the portfolio for some of these commitments. For Prosper Africa, you have Winnie Snyderman, who's sort of, be spearing Prosper Africa and make sure those efforts are supporting these African countries. U.S. doesn't have a choice but to do this because there are other, as I mentioned, Africa has a choice between, you know, Western partners and also, other partners, you know, and not just China. There's also India. You know, there's Russia, there's Brazil. You know, I think the U.S. is from the outset, this is a good first step. You know, and after 2014, you had mentioned you think this could be a annual. I don't know if we could do annual. I think the right one will be like maybe a biannual or a biannual event where, you know, after 2 years, you come back and you do something. And I know there's some people say there should be something in Africa, right? Maybe for this year, there sort of could be something small regionally through some of these U.S. embassies, because some of the U.S. embassies are not being utilized, right? They don't have the support staff. I think that's another interview we can do in itself. But I think this first step is a good step. You know, to commit to the summit is one thing. To put resources behind is another thing. And then third, he put key people in these positions to make sure the U.S. is meaning this commitment. I like that. And then the diaspora council that he has an executive order for, phenomenal, right? Let's gauge him on that. Let's see what happens, after that. I mean, you and I know, I mean, we're part of DPIA. We have issues with lack of representation at State Department and USAID. We need to solve that because without people like us in those organizations, that we can't give an administration. It's kind of like having a car, right? You fix the engine, but your rotors are still need to get fixed. They need to be refurbished. We need people we need all representations in the Foreign Service and at aid so that not only when we make these commitments, but we have people who look like us who say, yeah, have you thought about this? Have you thought about that? You know, those are the critical decisions that only somebody unfortunately of color can make because they understand those implications because they've been there, right?
changing relationship between the U.S. and the 56 nations of the continent. Jude Moore served as Minister of Public Works in Liberia and is the director of the Africa Initiative at the Center for Global Development, a think tank. Jude Moore, welcome to the NewsHour, and thanks for joining us. So Vice President Harris is now the fifth high-ranking U.S. official to visit Africa from the Biden administration. What message do you take away from that about how the U.S. views the continent right now?
So I think, thanks for having me again. I think the first thing is that this is a stark change from the administration that came before. When the previous administration announced its Africa policy, there wasn't even a cabinet level official. This is the fifth high ranking official there. And we gauge the value of the relationship between any two places and how high the level of exchanges between them. This also follows from August of last year, the launch of the new U.S.-Africa strategy, then the Africa Leaders Summit. It seems that both in rhetoric and perception, and we're looking to see in substance that the U.S. is actually backing up President Biden's declaration that the U.S. is all in Africa and is going to treat Africa as partners.
So let's talk about some of that substance now. We saw Vice President.
Like the rebalance of power. And we talked about that in our previous episode on why Black Americans should care about Ukraine. And, you know, there just was the recent U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit. And, you know, the United States was talking about business and trade with Africa and other issues of democracy and governance, but definitely on the trade and business side. And there's also this discussion of like U.S. supporting efforts for Africa to be part of the U.N. Security Council. Security Council. So just kind of wondering like how realistic you think we'll be able to push that before Biden ends his first term in office, and just where Africa is in terms of where its level is in the shift, the global power shift as relates to, especially after COVID and Ukraine, COVID-19 Ukraine.
Entire continent is vital, you know, not just resources, but talent, you know, that the continent has and will continue to have the youngest population on the planet. And that's important for many reasons, right? So that's the kind of larger Africa snapshot. But when we zero in on particular states, I think that's like a better way to talk. Our continent is vital, you know, not just for resources, but talent, you know, that the continent has and will continue to have the youngest population on the planet. And that's important for many reasons, right? So that's the kind of larger Africa snapshot. But when we zero in on particular states, I think that's like a better way to talk about it, right? Because Africa is a big continent. What is it, like 56, 57 countries? So which African countries are better positioned than others, right? I was reading this article, I think it on through the Atlantic Council, written in 2021. And the question was, or the thesis was, these are the three countries that should be considered for UN Security Council. It was Nigeria, DRC, and South Africa. Now, I definitely have my druthers of what I think should be the country that should be on the Security Council. But the issue of governance and stability, that's key, right? Because even when we think about Nigeria, when we think about the size of Nigeria, when we think about the Nigerian diaspora, when we think about all the contributions that Nigerians have made, not just in Nigeria, but outside of Nigeria, and why it's such an important partner and ally, and then their natural resources, Nigeria is key. But again, you know, I'm a security person. And so the first thing I think about is Northern Nigeria. And I think about the insecurity regarding terrorism. That's a very real thing.
Yeah.
In order for there to be partnership and allyship, you have to be in a country where you feel safe and where you don't feel like maybe you might get kidnapped. Mm-hmm. An American was recently released in Niger. Which also has a terrorism problem. And right now, parts of Africa account for about 20% of global terrorism.
Wow. And
Afghanistan accounts for another 20% of global terrorism. So 20% is not a small number, and we're and it's not just concentrated in Nigeria. But my point being, while Nigeria is definitely an important key ally and partner, it is that governance piece. It is that geopolitical security piece that needs to get strengthened for investors to feel safe to go there to do business, right? Because unfortunately, a lot of countries, and this has happened historically over time, have leaned into kidnapping as revenue. And so it's difficult to get people at the table to say, hey, let's do business, right? When you can possibly get kidnapped for being an American or being a Christian. So that's one part of it. And of course, you know, we look to Ghana, and that's a place where I spent time, and I'm eager to get back there because I know when I was there, there were some challenges that I faced as a Black American. And I know that Ghana's done a lot of work to address some of those issues. So I'm excited to get back there. And, you know, I'm excited about the partnership, and I'm saying that word intentionally because that's what it needs to be.
This in Africa started with slavery. When slavery had lost its value, it graduated into colonization. And that is the context in which Berlin must be seen. When the European powers sat in Berlin and divided the continent of Africa into spheres of influence. When colonization had lost its luster through a combination of certain realities and agitation from the continent, we regained our independence, but as John Henry Clark, that great African-American, said, we regained independence by mimicking European governance systems. And he rightly says, no African country will ever succeed on the basis of those systems. After that, the neo-colonial project was instituted, and all of us will remember Kwame Nkrumah's book, Neocolonialism, The Last Stage of Imperialism. And he there says, the most dangerous. We are now in a neocolonial stage. When the European powers are at their most diabolical, when the Americans are at their most diabolical, and it's not lost on me that they...
It cannot be some, you know, new form of colonialism. It can't be America leading. It has to be in partnership with. And the Vice President, when she visited the three countries recently, she was very clear on using the word partner and the word with, not the U.S. is, you know, going to Africa and telling Africans what to do. I remember being at the summit in December in DC, and I think it was President Bio who said that we're here in good faith, and but what we're not here for is for Americans to tell Africans what to do. And that resonated with me. And it resonated with the administration, I can tell you that. So it's no small thing that a course correction has been made in terms of our relationship and partnership with the continent writ large, but very, very specific partners.
I mean, speaking of Paris trip, I mean, there has been some criticism with, you know, her touting the LGBTQ line and saying that was a big human rights issue when it comes to African countries. Like, I mean, what do you think about that? Do you think that is a major policy issue to discuss on that first trip? Or could there have been other topics that are a little bit more pressing that Africans, like, for example, trade or business? Or so I just kind of wanted to get your perspective on some of the pushback from her trip. And did it really strengthen U.S.-Africa relations? I know there's a lot of countries there, but at least the diplomatic relations we did have, did that trip like solidify the U.S.-Africa trade summit that we just had in December?
I answer the latter first. I mean, I would say so. I mean, she went there with the checkbook. She said, we giving y'alls, we investing some money in y'alls. Like, you know, it wasn't a situation where it was just like a lot of, it wasn't a word salad going around to these countries and just saying words without anything to back it up. So she came ready. She had receipts, like literally. Mm-hmm. So in that regard, you know, investing in women, investing in trade and tech and clean energy, right? And, you know, to your question, you know, should she have talked about LGBTQIA rights? I say yes, and I'm going to tell you why. If we do not talk about these things as something that is part of our standing policy and not just when we may feel it's convenient, then we don't mean what we say. Mm-hmm. If we're not talking about women, if we're not talking about girls, if we're not talking about diversity in other kind of ways all the time, then we don't mean it. That's just how I feel. Mm-hmm. The criticism, not, there were some human rights criticisms, but it was human rights criticisms, not necessarily from the ones that I heard about identity per se. It was more around, how can you come here talking about what we're doing wrong on a human rights front, and there's a mass shooting every other day?
That was a criticism I heard too.
That is a valid point. Mm-hmm. That is a valid point. And although I'm less on the domestic security side, it does fall into the purview of terrorism. So I'm very interested in it, you know, from a domestic terrorism angle, and then just being a Black person in this country, I'm interested in my own safety, my family and friends' safety, right? So that, things like that can have the potential to undermine what the U.S. is trying to do abroad, right? Because there's no escaping that. That's a valid criticism.
Yeah, that's a real valid criticism. You know, I've heard, like, you know, children's rights, that's so fundamental. I mean, of course, we want to
women's rights,
LGBTQ and others, but children, like those who are innocent, but society can't even protect its kids. Mm-hmm. Like, as children, like, how do we move forward as a real democracy? So I guess, like, based on your opinion, you feel like her trip was a success, it was a good opportunity to push U.S. Africa policy, if you will.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that this was really, you know, I've been, you know, team VP, you know, but also I live in California, so I know her record here. And I just remember being very proud watching her as a senator, you know, and her taking certain folks to task, honey, and, like, you know, really doing a thing. But this trip for me, she was the stateswoman, Vice President Kamala Harris. I think that she shined in a way that felt more authentic, you know, especially when she went to the slave castle. And I don't know if you've ever had that experience, but it's profound. And she connected with people in a way, even down to her hair getting poofy, girl. Like, we didn't all have that experience if you've been on the continent.
I don't even bother with getting the relaxed or
straight. Okay, nothing works. I have locks and my hair was still all over my head.
Yeah, she was real. It was
authentic. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm like, you know, you know they were back there trying their hardest, honey, but they didn't do. And so, like, that hair was just, and I loved it. You know, she was regal and she was confident and respectful. It wasn't this kind of egotistic narcissism that the U.S. has oftentimes been accused of, right? It wasn't that. And I think that's what people needed to see. And from what I understand, she left genuine positive impressions everywhere she went.
But do you I've had a brief encounter
with her. Go ahead.
Just saying, Biden, I mean, there were just some concerns if Biden was going to go before he ends his first term. And, you know, he still hasn't gone to the continent. So is that kind of like a snub to African countries for him not to at least go to the continent?
No, a snub. Oh, my Lord. Child, listen, people just be trying to find stuff. No, it's not a snub. A snub would have been for there to have, you know, zero presence. And honestly, I just think, and I've heard from diaspora brothers and sisters that they like dealing with diaspora folks. Like it's almost like a preference, not to say that they wouldn't be happy, you know, if the president went. I'm not trying to put that out there, but this was important for the first Black Southeast Asian woman to go. And then she also has that connection with her grandfather there. The Secretary of State has gone. The Undersecretary, Bonnie Jenkins, has gone. Like, this administration has had vital, you know, stakeholder boots on the ground. So the president, yes, it would be amazing if the president goes. But in my experience with this administration, it's not just about the one person. I think that this particular vice president has been one of the most active and visible vice presidents, maybe actually in the history of vice presidents, if I'm being honest. And I'm not mad at it, to be honest with you. I'm not mad at it. I think it was wonderful that she went. And no, I do not think it's a snub at the president. Okay.
All right. So we got a B plus or an A plus on that trip.
On that trip. You know, I'm gonna keep my grading to my classroom.
Okay. Well,
I'm in trouble up here on this podcast.
I know, right? Well, now, okay, so we've sent Biden, we've sent Undersecretary Bonnie Jenkins, we've sent Secretary Blinken, Secretary of State to Africa. Do you feel like this will shift Africa's interest in terms of when it comes to Ukraine, like it will shift how they support the United States on this issue and other global issues, like especially at the UN level? Do you feel like it'll combat whatever China and Russia is trying to do in terms of galvanizing support and interest on the continent?
Mm-hmm. It's a good question, you know, because, you know, we all saw those videos of, you know, some Ethiopians lining up wanting to go fight for Russia. Again, you know, this is an information security issue. I was recently contacted by someone wanting to know about the intentional newsrooms that are set up to intentionally distill misinformation and disinformation on the continent. Mm-hmm. So it's all about relationships. And I think this is why it's important. So if you are living in an African state and seeing that Ukraine is, the US is, you know, has been this longtime oppressor, we've come in and we've given you infrastructure and roads and all these different things, then of course, you know, then your mind might be swayed to not support the West in terms of making sure that Russia doesn't advance beyond Ukraine. I think that it's an information war on the continent. That's what I honestly think. I think that there are valid criticisms about our historic partnership, not even partnerships, but our historic dealings on the continent and other spaces. And memories are long, you know, And I think this is why it's important to have such a high level presence on the continent to say, hey, we're here, you know, we're not just, these are not just words. So, you know, we'll definitely see in terms of the information war, because that's really what it comes down to. But our partners and our allies are definitely our partners and our allies. And the United States understands that, you know, we are definitely in strategic competition with China. We haven't shied away from that. You know, the United States absolutely understands that. And the messaging has been very clear about that. So the United States knows that it has to step its diplomatic game up in order to make meaningful partnerships, to have meaningful allies, and we need them.
Yeah, I mean, especially on the Security Council, I think that could be a good way, a good measure stick, if we can push that hardcore as a way of stepping up our diplomatic relations with Africa, you know, just giving them that power, getting them more into these international organizations, just having more of an Africa voice in the United States supporting that. It will be interesting to see how far, to what extent we're able to do that. So
I'd say that we are a lot closer than we were a few years ago.
Okay. All right, Biden. Biden administration's he's done some big things on the African diaspora in Europe and Africa, and Brittany Griner. Well, I just want to thank you so much for this opportunity to talk to us about just kind of like rating the U.S. The Biden administration on this U.S. Africa and African diaspora policy. So I really appreciate your time, and thanks so much for joining us on Global Take.
Thank you so much, and I always enjoy being here. I look forward to next time.
Okay. And that does it for us on Global Take, where we discuss global issues from the Black perspective. If you enjoyed this episode, please like us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or LinkedIn. You can find us at Black Professionals and International Affairs at www.iabpia.org. You can also find all podcasts on Spotify as well as Apple Podcasts. So please like and leave a comment. Thank you.